Well, when Carol and I come to this aspect of this seminar, we do it with a little bit of fear and trembling because it is such a delicate subject and such a personal subject, and yet one that we have learned in talking to many people is a very needy thing to be talked about. It's sort of, from our perspective, the frosting on the cake, though, to a good marriage. That's what I call it. What do you call it, honey? The oil in the machinery or something like that? I can't remember. But it's sure fun. And it sure makes life exciting. Now, when God created man and woman, he made them male and female, as we've read about in the Genesis account. And he mentioned there right at the tail end of that first chapter, "Behold, it is very good." And according to God's own wisdom and design, sexuality was ordained for three basic purposes. One, the propagation of the human race. Secondly, for an expression of that kind of love between a man and a wife, which nourishes true oneness. And thirdly, for pleasure. And in my opinion, neither the distorted image of somber negative Puritanism, which formulated the philosophy of sex here in this country and others for many years, nor the new morality or situation ethics, which throws off all restraints and argues for sexual freedom, is really an accurate picture of what the Bible teaches regarding sex. According to the Bible, sex is a gift from God with a purpose. And the three things that I just mentioned are the three purposes. One, to provide for parenthood. In other words, the propagation of the human race. And this is talked about in passages like Genesis 1, 27 and 28. Genesis 9, 1 and Psalm 127, 3. Secondly, it has been given to us by God to promote mutual love. It is probably the highest expression, the highest outward expression of what the Scripture means when it says, "And the two shall become one flesh." It's beautiful. And that statement is made, as I mentioned, four times in the Scriptures. In the passage that we read in Genesis 2:24, again in Mark and Matthew 19:5, and in Mark 10:7, and then in the Ephesians 5 passage, verse 31. A man shall leave his father and mother and cleave unto his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. Now, those two aspects of sex are, from a Christian standpoint, from a biblical standpoint, are pretty obvious. Certainly the propagation of the human race is, it's obvious that if God wanted to do that, he had to have a way of doing it, and he invented sex in order to accomplish that purpose. But in light of that, it is interesting to me, as I have just thought about it and pondered on it, that God should come up with a way of promoting the human race that was so irresistible that man and woman can't stay away from it. Not if they, even if they wanted to. With all the setting of the jaw and the gritting of the teeth, the human race is going to grow. God made sure of it. And in one way, that's rather awe-inspiring, and in another way, I kind of have to chuckle at it because he sure invented something that was unique and ingenious to promote the growth of the human race. Fantastic. And then the third thing, which is really what I'm referring to here, the third reason that God gave it to us is just for our enjoyment, for pure pleasure. And I believe this is very clear in the Scriptures. You look at 1 Corinthians 7, for instance. Verse 3. Carol is going to get into this a little more deeply, but I just want to refer to it in passing. It's talking here about concerning matters that apparently the Corinthians had written to Paul about, and he says in verse 2, "But because of the temptation to immorality, each man should have his own wife and each woman her own husband." The pull of the sex drive is so great that he gives us this warning about it, especially to those who are unmarried. And then concerning the husband and the wife, in verse 3, he says, "The husband should give to his wife her conjugal rights." That's what my translation said. That doesn't really ring the bell with me. I never really think a whole lot in terms of conjugal rights. "And likewise, the wife to her husband." What it really means here, it's talking about the pleasure that is rightfully owed by the husband to the wife and vice versa. To enjoy one another. If you will, to enjoy one another's bodies. God has given us to each other for that purpose. Now, sex, as I have said, is a God-given drive. And every God-given drive has a design in which it is to operate. For instance, hunger is a God-given drive. He also realized that he had to do something about this matter of keeping us alive in order to propagate the human race, because dead people do not reproduce. And in order to stay alive, we have to eat. Well, if there was not some mechanism that God had built within this body to indicate to me and to you that, oh, it's time to eat. Why? I'm hungry. It's a God-given drive in order to keep us going, to keep us moving, to keep us alive. If we never had any hunger pangs, you know, there'd be a lot of people starved to death without realizing it. They're just so busy, they'd forget to eat. A lot of women, you know, they'd love that. Keep them slender and trim. A lot of guys like me would kind of like it too. The battle of the bulge. But hunger is to be handled within the framework, or it is to operate within the design of moderation. And the Scriptures are quite clear on this. And some of us don't handle that all too well. The spare tire around the middle is an obvious indication that we have problems in this area. I personally feel that ambition in many people is a God-given drive. But it is to be handled within God's design. And God's design is His will. What is His will for your life? And I feel that as long as I am in His will, in that job, in that situation, and I am walking daily in the light of His will, that there is absolutely nothing wrong with ambition, of getting ahead, of getting it done, of initiative, of creativity, of moving out. As long as I'm operating within His design. Now, sex is the same way. It's a God-given drive, but it has a design which God has very clearly indicated to us in His Word, in which it is to operate if it is to produce harmony, happiness, and freedom from heartache. And that design is marriage. It is to operate only within the design of marriage. And this is very clear in the Scriptures. And you know, I'm not here to argue with you about that. To me, it's very obvious that this is God's pattern and plan. And I am totally convinced that those who take this great and wonderful thing that God has given to us and misuse it and abuse it, they will have a hard time convincing me that they are happy and satisfied and finding fulfillment for a very long period of time. And I don't care whether it's Hugh Hefner or one of his cohorts or anybody else. I've read enough about that guy to know that he is far from what I would call happy, in spite of his whole Playboy philosophy, which is, of course, diametrically opposed to God's design and plan and program for this matter of sex. Now, I emphasize this matter of pleasure because of two things. In the Christian world, there are times when sex is looked upon at arm's length, and there are people who are Christians who still have the carryover of the Puritan ethic built within them, and therefore it's a contaminated thing. And this can have devastating effects upon young people if they grow up in that kind of an environment when they reach the marriage bed. I emphasize it from the other standpoint that there is so much that goes on in our world today that plays free and loose with the whole idea of sex, which is sort of the Playboy philosophy, that looks so glamorous and so beautiful and is portrayed in such a magnificent way and with so much money spent behind it. But in God's plan and in His program with this matter of sex, He's given it to us to enjoy. And we should not be ashamed of that, but to enjoy within His plan and within His design. And there's a couple of beautiful illustrations of this that to me are kind of just really great. And I'd like to call them to your attention. Genesis chapter 18. Now this is the story of Sarah and Abraham. And I'm calling it to your attention to point out to you that Sarah looked at this matter of sex from the standpoint of pleasure. Now, of course, you got to remember that where we're dipping into their lives here, they're getting along in years. In fact, Abraham is 100 years old and Sarah is about 90. And, you know, I'm not sure what it's like when you get that old. But something had happened. And, of course, you remember the story that God had promised to Abraham a son, and that his seed would become as the sands of the seashore and as the stars of the heaven. And at this point in their lives, at 100 years old and 90 years old, he didn't have a son yet. But he was depending upon the promises of God, even at that age. And so we dip into the story in chapter 18 at verse 9, and it says, God has come along and He is speaking now to Abraham. It says, they said to him, where is Sarah your wife? And Abraham said, well, she's in the tent. And the Lord said, I will surely return to you in the spring, and Sarah your wife shall have a son at age 100 and at age 90. And Sarah was listening at the tent door behind him. Now Abraham and Sarah were old, advanced in age. It had ceased to be with Sarah after the manner of women. Now that could mean a number of things, but I'm taking it to mean that she couldn't probably have any children anymore, and that they probably weren't enjoying one another in bed very often. So Sarah laughed to herself, saying, now get what she says. After I have grown old and my husband is old, shall I have a son? And then what she says, Shall I have pleasure? You know what was on her mind? And I think that's, you know, we think of those Old Testament saints, Abraham and Sarah, as being kind of a little more than really mortal. And we put them up on a pedestal and, you know, they're not really like we are. They don't have exactly the same feet of clay and so forth and enjoy the same things we did and have the same weaknesses. But that, if you really read into their lives, you find that that's not true. They're very human. They're wonderful people, but they're just like we are. When I am so old, shall I have pleasure? Now, out of her mouth came the thoughts of her heart. Of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaketh. That's what the Scripture says over in Matthew 6. Now, it goes on and it says, and the Lord said to Abraham, well, why did Sarah laugh and say, shall I bear a child now that I'm old? I mean, that thought God recognized, and that was the uppermost thing in his mind, was the fact that he was going to give them a child, and it was a miracle baby, going to be a miracle baby. But the thing that was on Sarah's heart was something different. Beautiful, huh? And sure enough, boy, the next spring, they had a son, Isaac. Now, something happened, huh? They enjoyed one another. Take a look at Genesis 26. Of course, you know, even though they were so old, it is a miracle, but as someone has said, resurrection power works best in a cemetery. Genesis 26. Verse 8, but we'll start with verse 6. Now this is Isaac and his wife Rebekah. And they're down in Gerar. It says, so Isaac dwelt in Gerar. When the men of the place asked him about his wife, he said, she's my sister, for he feared to say my wife, thinking lest the men of the place should kill me for the sake of Rebekah, because she was fair to look upon. What a terrible thing to do. I mean, you talk about human nature, brother. That's a real example of it. Lying about his wife and calling his wife his sister so the people there wouldn't kill him to get at his beautiful wife. What a lousy guy. Yet he's one of the patriarchs of the Old Testament, Isaac, the offspring of Abraham. Verse 8, when he'd been there a long time, Abimelech, king of the Philistines, looked out of a window and he saw Isaac fondling Rebekah. Now, in one translation, it says sporting with. And I'm sure they weren't playing chess. So Abimelech called Isaac and he says, behold, she's your wife. How could you tell us she was your sister? Now, apparently, Isaac was doing something with Rebekah that he would not ordinarily do with his sister. And Abimelech realized that. Whatever that word means, fondling, sporting with, they were enjoying one another. So God has given to us this wonderful thing of sex. For our pleasure, for our enjoyment. The book of Proverbs, especially chapter 5, verses 15 and 19, talks about this, and Carol will refer to this passage. The whole book of the Song of Solomon is really a love poem between two people who are madly in love with one another. Obviously, a husband and a wife. And it uses very intimate and beautiful, and yet beautiful language in talking about this relationship that they have together. So the Scriptures are full of this thing. Now, let's turn to the practical side of this matter of sex, the physical relationship, for just a minute. Carol and I have talked about some of the differences that exist between men and women. And the differences that exist here in this matter of sex are quite dramatic. And unless we are willing to recognize them and make adjustments accordingly, it is going to affect your sex life as a married couple. Now, let me suggest three or four of the differences between a man and a woman when it comes to sex. With a man, sex is more of just an act, an interlude in time. With a woman, sex is involved in all of life. It is part of the drama. Now, guys, I stand here and I tell you that, and I say those words, and yet I am not sure that I fully understand what I'm saying from a woman's point of view. But I know she does. And in fact, you will notice a difference when she gets up here and starts talking about sex in just the way she talks about it and how I talk about it. And I can't help that. It's the way it comes out. For a man, it's an act. For a woman, it's part of the whole drama of life. For a man, it's a strong physical drive accompanied with emotional needs. For a woman, it is strong emotional needs accompanied with physical needs. In many times with a woman, it is more of a psychological thing than it is a physical thing. With a man, it is more important how often. With a woman, it is more important how. Quality versus quantity. With a man, he is quick to react to stimulation. With a woman, she is comparatively slow to react and needs to be stimulated. Now, if you guys are not aware of that one, you need to be, and you need to talk about it with your wife, and you need to figure out what it is you need to do in order to meet her needs in this area. With a man, he is primarily stimulated by seeing. With a woman, she is primarily stimulated by touch and by tenderness. It's part of the environment. It's part of the drama. That's why the tenderness is such an important thing. For a man, his basic makeup sexually, his basic makeup is more sexual than paternal. Whereas with a woman, her basic makeup is more maternal than sexual. In other words, a man is a lot less inclined to think of the product of the sex act resulting in a son or a daughter, whereas a woman is more inclined to think of it along those lines, that she's liable to end up being a mother. Now, I think I could summarize everything that I've said on the matter of these differences with just a little illustration. In comparing a man sexually to an electric light bulb, you flip a switch and on it goes. A woman is more like an electric iron. You flip the switch and it takes a little time to warm up. And also you flip off the switch, takes a little time to cool off. Now, guys, if you don't remember anything else I've said, please remember that, because it's very important. In the matter of learning to be a lover, and men, that's what we need to learn. We need to learn to be lovers. Don Juans, if you will, to satisfy the needs that that gal has that sleeps next to you in that same bed. And you know, I get so irritated sometimes with in talking to some men about this, when they tell me what their pattern is. They had the lovemaking instincts of a frog. Typical situation. I'll describe it to you. He gets home from work. They have supper. He gives her a little peck on the cheek. Dinner's over. He sits down, reads the paper, watches a little TV, and it gets to be bedtime. So he goes into the bathroom and takes care of things and changes clothes, gets into his pajamas, and then she does the same thing. And they both climb in bed, and they read a little while, and finally she reaches over and turns her light out, and he reads a few minutes longer, and finally he reaches over and turns his light out, and there they are, laying there in the dark. And then all of a sudden, out of the dark, comes this hand. What a romantic setting. What a psychological buildup. Like I say, the sexual instincts of a frog. Now, men, we can do better than that. And those gals deserve better than that. One time after we had had this thing, this seminar, a wife came up to me. I saw her, it was a month or so after she and her husband attended the seminar, and I ran into her someplace. She smiled and she says, "You know, Jim now on occasion in the afternoon will call me on the phone and we'll get to chat in. He'll say, by the way, honey, turn on the iron." You know, I think that's beautiful. That's fantastic. But you know, guys, that's what a woman needs. And boy, if we, you know, what you've got on your mind all day, sometimes, waiting to get home that night, and she doesn't know anything about it, and you get home and then that hand comes out of the dark. Boy, she's not ready for that. But before you leave the house in the morning, if you give her that little peck on the cheek or a good hug and a good kiss, and then say those few little words that most couples have got a little bit of patter between them that they know exactly what they mean. It's either verbal or nonverbal communication, or it's a little sly way of saying something now and then. She knows what you mean. That'll turn up her thermostat just a little bit and leave it on all day long. And by the time you get home, brother, the atmosphere has been created. And the evening is very enjoyable, and you can have a wonderful time that night. Now, guys, that's what a girl needs. That's what that gal that you love needs. Now, you gal, am I on track, or am I way off the beam, or, huh? Yeah, or no, or, yeah, okay, most of your heads are going like this. Okay, I just want to check in and make sure that I'm saying the right things. Well, I know my woman, and I know what it is that will turn her on, and I know it's my responsibility. And the thing that we both, Carol and I, and both encourage you to do in this whole area of the physical relationship is communicate on it. What is it that will meet your need as a wife, as a husband? What can he do that'll make it that much more enjoyable for you, or vice versa? Someone has said that what every man wants is an angel in the home and a tiger in bed. But sometimes, guys, if we do not communicate to that little gal, what it is that really turns us on, she'll never know. For instance, just take the matter of the degree of dress or undress. Have you ever talked about that together? What is it that she wears or doesn't wear that will really turn you on? Now, all of us are different on that score. I mean, you know, the black nightgown doesn't turn every guy on. Sometimes it's no black nightgown or something else. Now, those of us who've been married for quite a number of years, we've gotten very courageous in this area, and it really isn't much of a chore anymore for us to walk into the lingerie department of a big department store and buy something for our wives, some little thing, you know, and you walk up to the counter very bravely and with your chest stuck out, and like you do this every day of the week, you know, and say, I'll take one of those. But for you younger guys, you've got to get brave to do that. It takes courage just to get through that door of the department store. But why not, huh? Buy her some little thing once in a while and bring it home and let her know that it's a gesture of appreciation and love. It's probably something she'll only wear for you, but she'll love you for it. And it'll also let her know what turns you on. Now, I talked about the hand reaching out of the blackness, you know. That I'm sure that none of you guys are that way. But we do need to set the stage and use our imagination and be creative in this area, just like in other areas of our marriage relationship. And there are all kinds of things that I'm sure you've thought of and can do. Have you ever pretended, for instance? You know, here you are on a desert island with this gorgeous gal, and you know, you're isolated, there's nobody else around, water everywhere, and you don't have a boat. I mean, what are you going to do that night? Yeah, you can really let your imagination run loose and just have a great time loving one another. Or snowbound. Colorado, you know, we get snowbound. That's great. Let me just mention a couple of things that are from time to time problems, mostly mentally, just in the thinking processes of various people. You read marriage manuals, and in many of them, you get the idea that the ideal, the epitome of sex relationship between a husband and a wife is to have a climax together. Carol and I are a little bit turned off by this type of approach because it holds something out like a carrot, which need not be the case because it really isn't that important as long as both of you are enjoying it and both of you are reaching a climax, which, you know, if you're not, why, maybe you need to talk to somebody and get some help in this area. But it's a great thing if that happens. But don't hold it out as an ideal and feel that you are being coming short of that which is the greatest if you don't reach that ideal. The important thing is to enjoy one another. Another thing that is sometimes a misnomer is that, you know, it always ought to be just the greatest, thrilling, most exciting thing that has ever happened. Well, it's always thrilling and it's always exciting, but it's not always alike. Now, one of my favorite meals is to sit down to a nice big steak, a baked potato, some rolls, and a nice dessert. And I am perfectly, that is a banquet for me. But you know, I also like McDonald's hamburgers. I love McDonald's hamburgers. And I'm satisfied with either. Well, that's kind of the way it is in sex. Sometimes it's the steak and baked potato, and other times it's McDonald's hamburgers. But But it's always great. And it satisfies my need and hers. So, you know, recognize this and understand that that's just the way it is. And there's nothing wrong with you if it isn't, you know, the top of the mountain every time. Now, the last thing that I want to emphasize, and then Carol is going to come up and talk about this from a woman's viewpoint, and I'm repeating myself here, but I cannot emphasize the importance of this, and it's the very reason why we've got you husbands and wives together, and it's very difficult for us to talk about it in this way when both are present. It'd be a lot easier for me to get you guys off into a room and talk to you, and it's the same for Carol. I think it's a little harder for her than it is for me, but the reason we've got you here together is because we want you to both hear the same things, and we want you to talk about it. And we've discovered that this is probably the most neglected area of communications between a husband and a wife, is talking about the physical aspect of their marriage in a way that will be of benefit to both of them, to help us. So let me urge you to do that.